Dearest friends, it's the greatest pleasure for me to welcome you all here this evening. By a show of hands, how many people here have at one time or another been to Temple Emmanuel for whatever reason? Raise your hands. Okay, this is what we call regular worshipers. For how many of you is this your first time at the temple? Raise your hands. Okay, Kanai Nahara. Well, we all know that the mystique of Temple Emmanuel is shrouded in legend and in folklore. So let me speak to you as one Jew to another in a way that will help clarify and to dispel old Temple Emmanuel myths. Chushva and Tayor Afreint. Alephanins, their arbitu and dem shield, the rabunim, the administratia, and the chevruf and balabatim, ins allen zogen zeneich buruch abu, ins zenen zer and zer mechibid, as ihr zenen du gekimmen zu sein mit ins, in du zeheren, the chushev alexia in dem shield. That's the first language of Temple Emmanuel. And on behalf of the temple's board of trustees, our temple administrators, and the rabbinate, I would like to express to you deepest gratitude, especially deepest gratitude to the Jewish Week, especially to its editor and publisher, Gary Rosenblatt, for organizing this event. And to the Bird Cohn Family Foundation for making it possible. I would like to welcome to the Bima our three guests, each of whom is a committed believer in one way or another. All three of them certainly agree upon the place and the importance of the written word. And all of us can agree that Christopher Hitchens and Rabbi David Wolpe are both brilliant and prolific authors. We also stand firm in our conviction that Gary Rosenblatt is a wonderful editorialist and publisher. And assent to those observations may probably be the only agreement upon which we shall arrive this evening. So without any further beating around the ritual bush, I would like to welcome to the podium the president of the Jewish Week, Peter Wang.
This is cozy. I have this almost overwhelming urge to say Shabbat Shalom, but I will not. On behalf of the Jewish Week, I do want to welcome all of you, our words of welcome, to what promises to be an exciting and thought-provoking, entertaining debate. And I want to particularly thank Rabbi Posner, Executive Director Mark Weistuck, and the entire Temple Emmanuel family for hosting us this evening. I know there was some concern that having this event at a synagogue might give Rabbi Wolpe home court advantage, but we promised that the Hitchin camp that we will not crank up the organ tonight. Events like this don't happen without a lot of work and a lot of help, and I'd especially like to thank the Bert Cohn Family Foundation for its generous support of this program, as well as our own Jewish Week Foundation for its support in making this possible. And thanks as well to the staff of the Jewish Week, some of whom you'll meet will be going down the aisles during the course of the evening with questionnaires and question cards for you. And in particular, I want to thank Miriam Reinhardt, our program coordinator, for her terrific work in setting this up. Miriam, thank you. Just a very few words about the Jewish Week. The Jewish Week is not only America's most respected Jewish newspaper, it is the central information agency for our Jewish community in New York. Through our newspaper, our website, and our events like this, like last year's conference held at Temple Emmanuel, where we hosted Daniel Libeskind, Gay Talese, Jonathan Safran Foer, and over 750 people attended. And tonight, I should tell you that we have about 2,000 people in attendance, so I thank all of you. We're able to bring you news, commentary, and opinions on every spectrum and from every angle of Jewish life. For those of you who are our regular readers, I thank you. And for those of us joining us for the first time and seeing what we can do tonight, this is a taste of what we bring you every week. So I hope you'll join us. I hope you'll join us every week and at programs like this for many, many years to come. Let me now introduce Gary Rosenblatt, our editor and publisher, as well as the moderator for this evening's program. Gary.
There you go.
Thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening for our Jewish Week Forum on Is Religion Good for the World? And I want to renew my thanks for all of those who have been thanked already, but deeply appreciated for all the work that went into making this possible. So take a moment and just look around this beautiful sanctuary and at this turnout. I hesitate to use the word miraculous, but consider that it's a cold, windy, midweek evening, and it is pretty remarkable. We've held many Jewish Week forums over the last dozen or so years because we feel that our role is not only to cover the Jewish community, but to be part of it as well. And in a sense, this forum is a bit of what we try to do each week, dealing with important and provocative topics in a way that is inclusive as possible, offering up sharp differences at times, but in as respectful a way as possible. So I'm looking around and wondering why this one has been by far the largest turnout. I'm just curious how many of you have been to previous Jewish Week events? Right. And how many knew about this from the paper? Well, that's very heartening. So welcome to you all. And I had a couple of theories about why this turnout. One could be that New Yorkers, whether they are Met or Yankee fans, are in denial that the World Series is going on without them. So they just don't want to be home watching TV tonight and dealing with reality. It could be that so many of us are conditioned to attending the recent high holiday services during the middle of the week that you just naturally felt yourself gravitating here. Or it could be that you saw the word debate in the Jewish Week ads for tonight's program, and you're so used to watching presidential and vice presidential debates over these last weeks and months that you just decided you had to be here. The difference is that at this debate, I suspect that neither speaker will be dropping his G's when speaking. Or speaking. But the real reason I suspect for this large turnout is the quality and the reputation of the speakers here. So let me introduce them briefly and explain the format for tonight's program. Obviously, we could read very long bios, and they are both worthy of them, but we'll keep it kind of brief. Christopher Hitchens is the author of the best-selling book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. A prolific writer and polemicist, he argues that religion is a toxic force that makes the world a more dangerous place. He contributes regularly to Vanity Fair, Slate, and the Atlantic Monthly. And his brilliant and passionate advocacy for the cases, for the causes he believes in, make his writing so compelling. And I have to share with you my favorite blurb in praise of his writing of this book was from Esquire, which wrote, "Thank God for Christopher Hitchens." Rabbi David Wolpe is the author of the new book, Why Faith Matters, named the number one rabbi in America by Newsweek magazine. He's the senior rabbi at Sinai Temple in Los Angeles and argues powerfully for the place of God, faith, and religion in modern life. He writes for many publications, including BeliefNet.com, the Jerusalem Post, the LA Times, and we're proud to say the Jewish Week, where his weekly musings column is as incisive as it is brief. Not an easy thing to do as a writer, trust me. So welcome to you both. Now, as far as the format, yes. Each of our speakers will present his views here from the lectern for 7 minutes, and then we're going to give each of you 5 minutes to respond. And then, more informally, I plan to ask you some questions, and we'll get into hopefully a more free-flowing kind of conversation. We also want to hear from you in the audience, so we've set aside time for questions from you in written form. We've distributed index cards for you to write your questions down, and we have several staffers and others helping us, so you'll see them going through the aisles, collecting cards, and they'll bring them up to me. So I urge you to keep your questions brief. That's why we provided you with index cards, and legible, as penmanship counts. And at the end of the program, we will have Rabbi Wolpe and Mr. Hitchens each give us a three-minute summation for their final remarks. So for those of you keeping track of time, we will conclude before 9:15. And at that point, following the program, everyone is invited to join us for a reception downstairs in Wise Hall. And copies of the author's books will be on sale there. And they've graciously agreed to sign them for you. We also have copies of the Jewish Week and some of our other publications. So we hope you'll join us after the program. My final request is to please turn off your cell phones. And we begin with Christopher Hitchens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Shalom. I thought I had been to the largest Jewish temple in the world, the shul in Budapest, where Theodor Herzl once used to attend. But I'm told that, and I now believe it, that this one outranks it. The last one I went to, because usually I don't go into houses of worship unless I'm wearing about a ton of garlic around my neck, was the very tiny temple on the Tunisian island of Djerba, the foundation stone of which is said to have come from the original temple itself, a wonderful gem, little gem of a synagogue, blown up in 2003 by Al-Qaeda, but recently repaired along with its tenacious community. So comparing and contrasting that miniature and that grandiosity, I'm very glad to find myself this evening speaking in what appears to my disordered senses to be the dining room of Hogwarts School. though I dare say I couldn't have picked a less apt name for a Jewish house of worship. I also have a question. Just before we start, I'd like everyone to put up their hands. Who knows why the World Series is called the World Series? One. And she could be wrong. Feverishly, for years, I asked, when I arrived here as an immigrant from England, why do they call it the World Series? No one else in the world plays this game except Canada, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, and I think Japan. How dare they call it the World Series? No one could tell me why it's called the World Series. And no one here can either. This thing, why not? It's our game. Naturally, it's the World Series. And we're the world champions at it. The New York World, ladies and gentlemen, used to sponsor this series, a now defunct newspaper. That's why it's called the World Series. It could have been called the Post Series. It could have been called the Newsday Series. Just a warning against hubris before we start, and against man-made reification and myth of the sort that can turn into something rather dangerous, morally and intellectually, which brings me to my theme. When I was looking for a subtitle for my book, God is Not Great, I thought, let's not be sensational, let's not be catch penny, let's not be cheap, but let's try and get people's attention. I thought God is Not Great might do that already. I called it How Religion, Why Religion Poisons Everything. I knew what would happen. People would say, what, everything? What, you mean chess? You mean tantric sex? You mean tourism? It poisons everything? Well, in a way, as I've gone on with this debate, and as I persist in it tonight, and as I will tomorrow, I would be more and more willing, ever more willing to defend myself in saying that it's a universal toxin from which nothing is exempt. First, I believe and I maintain that it attacks us in our very deepest integrity, in the core of our self-respect. Religion says that we would not know right from wrong. We would not know an evil, wicked act from a decent human act without divine permission or without divine authority, or without, even worse, either the fear of divine punishment or the hope of a divine reward. It strips us of the right to make our own determination, as all humans always have, about what is and what is not a right and good action. To give a trivial example that I hope none of you will find really actually trivial. As you know from the archaeological work of Israel Finkelstein and others, the story of the wandering in exile described in Exodus is a mythical one. It's an entirely invented one, a metaphorical one at best, but it does tell a very important story, and it does say that after a very long wandering, my mother's ancestors got to the foot of Mount Sinai and were informed that perjury, theft, and murder were non-kosher. Now, my question to you is this. How far would the Jewish people have got? Would they have got that far, even wandering around in the desert, leaderless in sometimes ways, if they'd been under the impression that murder and theft and perjury were okay? I think it's an insult to have it said that that was the case. I think, in other words, that all one needs to know about is human solidarity and the need for it, and human evolution from the savannah and from the places in Africa where we very nearly died out, and were very nearly exterminated before the escape, that we wouldn't have made it this far if we didn't have this knowledge in us as innate. There is no need for divine permission. And those who say that there is are willing to prostrate themselves before an altar, and they may say, well, at least it's a Jewish altar. Well then, how will they deny the Wahhabi Muslim the right to say the same thing? To prostrate himself in front of God, the Salafi Muslim, to prostrate himself in front of God and say, only from you can I receive anything. Only from you can I receive an idea. Only from you can I receive a principle. Will we say, well, that's fine. Louis Farrakhan's racist crackpot cult organization can get black people off drugs in prison, they say. So they get the same privilege. It all comes from on high. That's the first point. The second point is, in a sense, imbricated in and necessitated by what I've just said. In the veil of tears in which we live, of insecurity, anxiety, doubt, combat and struggle, all these things, by the way, I think are good for us and help us to grow up. We shouldn't wish for a world where there was eternal peace and tranquility and banality. We should welcome the chance to take part in struggle and to be afflicted by anxiety. But in this world, there are problems that the human race has always faced and always will, and that philosophers have wrestled with and always will have to, and that aestheticians and artists have tortured themselves about. There's only one solution to this that doesn't work, and that is to refer it upward and to say, if only there was a celestial dictator who could just take this responsibility from us and legislate the whole thing for us and accept our blind, obedient, self-abnegating trust, then maybe everything would be all right. I hope it shouldn't be necessary to say in a place of this kind, in a refuge of this kind, that there is no totalitarian solution to our problem. That very fortunately, I think, we are on our own, and we have only our own responsibility and our own mentation and intellect and principle with which to face these things. It can't be said that a God whose authority is unchallengeable, who can convict you of thought crime while you sleep, who can tell you that you're condemned for something you thought you might do, who knows your thoughts, who has utter unchallengeable authority over you, whose rule makes that of Kim Il-sung make the idea of a celestial North Korea seem laughable, that such an authority can be the answer to our problems. No. It's perhaps, you might think, sad, but I think good that we don't have that resource. We cannot prostrate ourselves before a dictator, an absolutist, and we can't hope to refer these things upward. Well, those are my two main points, and I don't know how far I've got, but I must be trespassing on the rabbi's time. But I think I ought to add that if this belief was moral, because there are those who say, well, it may not be true, there may not actually be a God, the holy books may not tell a true story, they may be metaphorical, all the evidence is that all holy books are man-made, as all religion is, and not God-made. Nonetheless, still, we have our morality from them, and at least religion coerces people into behaving better. They don't, as an English duchess once said, they don't fornicate in the street and frighten the horses. That's all she asked of the lower orders. I think, again, we're being asked to insult ourselves and to disrespect ourselves and to think of ourselves as servile, as slave-like, as abject and lacking in self-respect. We don't need permission to act morally. Religion takes morality from us. Human solidarity is the basis of morality. We would not have come this far. We couldn't have lived this long. We couldn't have evolved this much if we didn't know that we had to look out for one another, and that well before Rabbi Hillel enunciates the golden rule, that the same instruction is found in the Analects of Confucius. Do not do to others what would be repulsive if done to you by another. These are insights that we possess innately as of right. And the last time that right was called divine, and that the idea that rights could only be derived from the divine, it was the divine right of kings, which replaced the idea of a celestial, unalterable dictatorship in heaven and said that it was the permission for totalitarian rule also by other human beings here on earth. And if you ask yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, brothers, sisters, comrades, friends, what is the greatest threat, not just to our moral but our physical survival, and what is the greatest insult to our intellectual integrity at present, I think at least a number of you would be inclined to agree with me that that threat is probably theocratic. That humans who claim divine authority, that humans who claim to tell us what to do, that humans who say they'll kill themselves, they're so keen to kill us, who have a cult of suicide, a death wish, and believe they have divine permission for it, are by far the most menacing of our foes. And that they don't just threaten us physically. They threaten all the gains of civilization, all the gains of thought and reflection and art and aesthetics. So that those who claim that they have a hotline to the Almighty or to God have a lot of disproving to do before they can show that they are not part, that they don't take a share in the worst and most impermeable tyranny that one could well face. I'm incredibly grateful to you for inviting me and very grateful to you for listening this far. Thank you.
In case I describe.
No, that won't do at all. First of all, before I say why that won't do, let me just tell you what a joy it is for a rabbi to speak to a different congregation than his own, because you haven't heard all my bits and stories and jokes. And many years ago, Harold Kushner, when he retired, told me that he used to think that the secret to the rabbinate was changing your sermons, but now he knows that it's just changing your audience. I want to address both points because both of them, I believe, are made right in the face of everything that we learn in our tradition. And by our tradition, I mean Judaism particularly, but not only Judaism. That is, in the tradition of the monotheistic faiths. And let me start with this idea that we didn't know murder, theft, perjury were bad until we found ourselves at the foot of Mount Sinai. In fact, I think that if you read the beginning of the Bible, which I strongly advise, you will find that Cain is condemned for killing Abel. Now, why is he condemned if the Bible assumes that you don't learn that murder is bad until you get to Sinai? After all, Cain is long before Sinai. Of course the Bible knows that human beings recognize that murder is bad. But the Bible also knows that they do it anyway. And that without a divine sanction against murder, people will think that it is a humanly invented sanction. And if they will violate it even when it's God's dictate, how much more will it prove to be, and I will come back to this, a fragile rule when it's the rule of human beings. And so at Sinai, what you get is not a series of moral rules that you never could have imagined for yourself. Oh, I thought it was fine to kill before I got here. But the knowledge that it is built into the moral structure of the universe. It's not a personal preference. It's not a societal rule. It is a mandate from God to all human beings. And if you think that mandate doesn't matter, all I can say is you haven't paid much attention to the 20th century. You know, in Karamazov, Ivan Karamazov in Dostoevsky's novel says famously, without God, everything is possible. Except that Dostoevsky feared that eventuality. The same conclusion was drawn by Nietzsche in Germany, but Nietzsche celebrated that eventuality as he had his madman run through the streets and say that we have killed God. Both of these prophets knew that we were coming to a time when a consciousness of God would not filter through Western society. And they recognized that things would be different. And in fact, Dostoevsky in Russia, leading to communism, Nietzsche in Germany, leading to Nazism, were exactly right. It's not that religious people always behave well. It's that the voice of Sinai makes a difference to individuals and to societies, and to suggest that it was a voice that taught us as opposed to reinforced is to make a mistake. And to assume that all you need, I am quoting now, all one needs to know is human solidarity seems to me to fly in the face of everything we know about human beings. If you think that people are basically good, then I suggest you visit a playground. What happens when a new child comes onto the playground? Do the other children go, oh, look, a new child. Let us embrace him and share our toys. Of course not. They say, get the new kid. Because there is an innate distrust of the other. And that has to be transcended by some principle that is greater than the group, such as there is one God, and that one God is sovereign over all, and that everybody is a sister and a brother. I mean, look, parents know this. If people weren't of mixed light and darkness, then it would be very easy to raise kids. You'd say, don't share so much. Don't be so good. Don't always behave. But civilizing a human being takes a lot of work. Rodgers and Hammerstein got it exactly wrong when they said that hate has to be carefully taught. It's goodness and love that have to be carefully taught. And that's the purpose of the Torah. It's not to tell you things that you don't know. It's to reinforce and give authority and depth and complexity and richness to what you do know, but you don't always do. That's the first point. And then the second point is what God is in the monotheistic traditions. God is not the tyrant of North Korea. First of all, by the way, just as an aside, as I mentioned in the book, it's very interesting that you got North Korea and South Korea. North Korea is an atheistic tyranny that Mr. Hitchens uses to compare to God. South Korea is a flourishing democracy and has a very strong Christian culture. So which one do you want to live in? You want to live in religious South Korea or atheistic North Korea? But that's just an aside. Here's back to the main point. If you think of God on a human analogy, the proper analogy is not a tyrant. It's not Big Brother. Mr. Hitchens wrote a very estimable book on George Orwell, and maybe that persuaded him to think of God in the way that we think of Big Brother. But in fact, think of it differently. Because he says, not only does God know what you do, God even knows your thoughts. What could be more frightening than that? Child psychologists tell us that before a child reaches the age of I, that is, the ability to say I, they don't know what is internal and what is external. Child cries, the breast appears. They don't realize that an outside agency is responding to them. Their mother, so to speak, is inside them. Does that cause fear? Or is that intimacy and love? Somebody who deeply believes in God does not feel that God's knowing them is tyrannical, is overbearing, is frightening, but rather is embracing and is beautiful. That's what it means to believe in the God of the traditions at their best. Are there contrary teachings? Absolutely. Religion is not univocal. It's been around for thousands of years, and lots of people have said many things, some of them foolish. Just ask Mr. Hitchens. He will give you a fairly startling catalog. But this is, in fact, the idea that human beings are all one, that there is a moral order to the universe, and that we are loved. And that's not a tyranny. That's the sovereignty of God. And that's why I want to close up by telling you that really this debate is based on a misperception. It has to do with what the religious person is. The religious person is not someone who totes up some arguments from column A and some arguments from column B. I taught for many years, and both in New York and in Los Angeles, theology, and I used to teach all the proofs, and I put that in quotation marks for God, the ontological proof, the teleological proof, the cosmological proof. I diagrammed them on the board, I explained them. I never had a student come up to me after class and go, "Now I believe." Because it is not an intellectual process by which we come to an understanding of God. Rather, it is something deeper. It's an orientation of the soul towards the universe. It's how you see the world. It's how you apprehend its beauty and its richness and its wonder and its love. And if you see it in a detached way, in a disenchanted way, and you say, what I need is proof, the same way that I need proof in a test tube or a laboratory, then you will not, in fact, discover what it is that the great traditions of the world mean when they say, Karov Adonai l'kol korav, l'kol asher yikra'uhu ve'emet. God is close to those who call upon God, to those who call upon God in truth. Thank you.
Done. I overran my time last time, so I'll try and condense and get nearer to our exchange this time. But
it's good to know you have a sense of Jewish time.
Right, Jewish time will do. Thomas Jefferson, whose biographer I am in a small way, once said, meditating on slavery in his notes on the state of Virginia, he said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." Once you've heard that statement, I'm sure many of you have heard or read it before. Once you have, as you'll know, you won't forget it again. You'll always remember that he said that. But when you think about it again, or even at all, you realize it's a nonsensical statement, almost an idiotic one. If there was a just God, what would there be to tremble about? If we were in the hands of a benign deity, a father who always looked out for us and wished for the best, where would be the rest of Jewish history? Where would be the rest of human history? There'd be nothing really to worry about. It would be like scraping your knee in the famous playground. How bad could it be? There's a just God. Now, I don't think anyone here who studied human society and human history and the human tragedy, whether you define tragedy as the Greeks did, as a fatal flaw in our own design, or whether you define it as Hegel did, as the terrible moment when there's a conflict between two concepts of right, you can't just say, well, thank heavens, at least Daddy is still on duty. And I'm afraid to say the only people who do say that are childish. It is a childish thing to say and a childish thing to believe. And the whole concept that we are God's children and that we have an eternal father is itself quite obviously man-made. Did man make God in his own image or God make man in his own image? Ask yourselves and see what your reason and what the evidence of your study of history and society will tell you for that. Now, I'm relatively impartial as between different monotheisms. I think Bertrand Russell is essentially right that they all make the same mistake. However, since you mentioned the tradition, Rabbi, let's agree that Judaism has a couple of claims it can make. It doesn't proselytize, and also anyone can join. That's not bad compared to some religions. It doesn't make the idiotic mistake of saying the Messiah has already come, so what's there to worry about? The greatest remark made, I think, is by the Rambam saying, okay, the Messiah will come, but he may tarry. In that sort of shrug, you have everything from Lenny Bruce to Woody Allen to Marx and Freud and Einstein. But to remind you of this is also to remind you that the great tradition, the really great tradition, is diaspora secularism, is not the belief that if you go on talking to a bit of wall in far-off Jerusalem, that you will be heard. That's a nonsensical belief and has led to terrible error. Now, on the Karamazov point, or rather, I think the character in the book is actually Smerdyakov, who says, without God, all things are possible. Let's examine. And let's examine what you said about divine condemnation of murder. I say that the condemnation of murder is human, that humans know without being told, whether it's Cain or whether it's any other example, without being told that this is a crime, an illness. You say, well, irrelevantly, I think, you say, well, Cain is understood to have been a murderer. Well, so would any human have known that he was, though there were only apparently about two other humans around at the time, if you believe this story. But here's the point. What about the divine mandates for murder? What about the times when God tells you, you must be a murderer? When God says you must destroy every member of the Amalekite tribe down to the last child, saving only a few virgins of theirs for purposes probably somewhat better imagined than described. What about that? What about the Quranic injunction to treat the Jews as if they were treacherous and murderous and deceitful? Wasn't that dictated by God also in the desert? What about His Holiness the Pope saying until 1965, ladies and gentlemen, that every Jewish person was collectively guilty of deicide? Wasn't that said by the vicar of Christ on earth, the man who held the keys of Peter, who had divine authority? By what right, Rabbi, do you say that you know God better than they do, that your God is better than theirs, that you have an access that I can't claim to have, to knowing not just that there is a God, but to knowing His mind? You put it modestly, but it is a fantastically arrogant claim that you make, an incredibly immodest claim, and if made by a fanatic, or by a bully, or by a murderer, I'll take it to the next stage and reply directly to Karamazov and Smerdyakov. Isn't it rather the case that with God, anything is permissible? Once someone has said, God told me to do it, what is not allowed? Is it not the case that the genital mutilation community, the child genital mutilation community, is exclusively religious? They only do it because God wants it done. The suicide murder community, pretty much exclusively theocratic. They only do it because God tells them to do it. The slavery community, there's no place in the world where slavery has ever been practiced when it hasn't been justified by reference to the holy books. Entirely religious. Isn't it the case that once people think they have divine permission, there's no crime, no wickedness, no cruelty, no misery that they won't inflict on their fellow creatures? If you accept the first injunction, it seems to me you are absolutely obliged to consider the second. And if we are made indeed in the image of God, if that is the case, then how do we explain the psychopath, the torturer, the Nazi, the sociopath, the sadist? Are these not also cast from the same coin and falling from the same press? I'll just have to close by denying what you say about North Korea, where I've been. I've been to all the axis of evil countries in my day. North Korea is the most religious state in the world, by far. I used to wonder when I was a kid, what is it like to praise God all day and thank him all the time, forever, always thanking, always praising, always groveling, always abject? What would that be like? They say that's what heaven is like. It sounds like hell to me, but I still couldn't picture it. Now I've been to North Korea. Do you know why President Bush writes to Kim Jong-il and calls him Mr. Chairman, not Mr. President? Do you know why? Because he's only the chairman of the Communist Party and actually the head of the armed forces. He's not the president of the country. The president of the country is his father, who's been dead for 15 years. So North Korea is a necrocracy, or a thanatocracy, or a mausolocracy. I tried all these in my time. And the son is the reincarnation of that father by official doctrine. And I'm sure I know, believe me, that I'm not speaking in a Christian church, but just to whisper, that's only one short of a trinity that they've got there. And it's worship all the day and all the time. But there is one difference. You can get out of it, North Korea. You can defect. You can die. You can damn well die and then you're rid of it. With monotheism and theocracy, you can't. Because it will pursue you after you're dead. This is totalitarianism, by definition. It is the most frigid, rigid, unalterable dictatorship. There's no appeal from it. It knows your thoughts. It can convict you of thought crime. It is much, much worse than Big Brother. It's much more sadistic. It's much more totalitarian. And there is so much reason to be grateful that there's absolutely no evidence that any rabbi or priest or mullah has ever produced that would make you believe there was a single word of truth in it. So at least we have that much to celebrate. Thank you.
That was a brief rebuttal, huh?
At least now we know what a brief rebuttal looks like.
Okay. I asked for that.
Listen.
I asked for it.
Yes. So let me start with North Korea. Let me start where you ended, and then I'll work my way back, which is, you know, it's a strange kind of dialectic when religious regimes are blamed for being religious and atheistic regimes are blamed for being religious. There seems to be no escape. Basically, if a country does something bad, it must be religious. But yeah. In fact, North Korea is the antithesis of what the monotheistic faiths say, which is you don't worship a human being. And you have gone on again and again about hubris. It seems to me that hubris is assuming that human beings are the best thing going. That's what you have to believe in a world without God, that we may be imperfect, but we are the best things going. I don't think we're the best things going. And I think the idea that we are is a frightening idea, not a reassuring idea. And as to the question with which Mr. Hitchens began, which is, if God is a loving God, then why do we have anything worse than scraping our knee? I have never done this in answer to the question of evil, but now I'm going to quote Mr. Hitchens. Because if you recall, in his initial talk, he said, I don't think a perfect world is a good world. I think a world of affliction and challenge and difficulty is a world of growth. That's exactly right. If you had a world, think for a moment, when people say, why do bad things happen to good people? Assume for a moment you had a world in which good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. Okay? You steal, you get a disease. Every time, right? As night follows day, would anyone steal? No. But their not stealing would have no moral content. They don't steal out of prudence. Out of caution, not out of goodness, not out of growth. When we train children, to recur to the theme of children and childishness, at first we give them rewards. We say, you do this, I'll give you a reward. But the time comes when you want them to do it for its own sake. And everybody knows, every human being knows, that you can be the best person who ever lived and still lead a terrible life. But that your goodness is goodness. Not calculation, not prudence, not the idea that God promises you if you just propitiate God enough that you'll get saved. And let me just close, although I did, by the way, I don't make any claims to prophecy, but I told you that you would hear a litany of bad things that religions do, which they do, although I must say, that I still think that if you tote up the scoreboard, Mr. Hitchens talked about slavery, for example, and he said, you know, no place does slavery exist without reference to the holy books. I think he's forgetting Rome, Greece, Assyria, Babylonia. It was actually civilizations that had holy books that abolished slavery, not that created slavery. And those who abolished it, like Wilberforce and Brown and so on, were evangelists and used the Bible to abolish it. But let's put that aside.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Let's do that.
The justification of slavery is biblical.
No. I didn't. You can't. You're not allowed to interrupt.
Okay. They're not rhetorical questions, then.
What? You asked rhetorical questions. I can ask rhetorical.
You didn't take me up on them. You should.
But remember.
I wouldn't complain.
Now, don't try to convince them that good manners
don't
are
whine.
Religious virtue.
Don't
I don't
whine.
Think that
don't
that's.
No whining.
I want to close with this, and I know that this may be unfairly personal, but in part, we're talking about our two books, and because this is part of what the book is about, I'm going to go there. It's not about getting goods from God. That's not what religion is. Part of the book talks about my own experience with my wife's having cancer, mine having a brain tumor, and my having gone through chemotherapy a couple of years ago for lymphoma. And as I was going through chemotherapy, I was very well aware that asking God to heal me wasn't going to mean that I was healed. That God doesn't work that way, that God wouldn't say, you know, Wolpe in bed two prayed. So him I'm going to heal. Bed three, I haven't heard word one. Bed three can go. And I didn't feel betrayed when I found out that I was in remission but not cured, and that I may never be. Because what I prayed for wasn't a doctor in the sky. What I prayed for was closeness. What I prayed for was the certainty that I was not alone. What I prayed for was blessing and love, not magic. Durkheim, the great sociologist, pointed out a long time ago that there are not churches of magic, there are churches of religion, because it's social, it's congregational, it's what we do together as well as what we do with God. Don't think for a minute that because some people misuse that, that that force isn't real, and that God can't touch human life. And it is true that God can be pushed away. But after all, as the Kotzker Rebbe said a couple hundred years ago to his students, where does God dwell? And they said, that's easy, God dwells everywhere. And he said, no, God dwells wherever we let God in.
Rhetoric.
Schmoll.
What do you want? Yeah.
Okay. We are, I guess, resuming what you call the oldest argument in human history.
Yes.
Right? And we're certainly there. One question that comes to mind after hearing both of you, and I'd ask you both to respond, maybe we'll start with you, David, is in doing your research and engaging in other discussions, other debates about God, and from tonight as well, what's the most compelling case that the other side has made?
You want me to give away the game? Are you going to ask him the same? Okay,
yes.
Fair enough.
All right. What gives you pause?
You want to know really what gives me most pause, honestly? I'll tell you what is hard for me. For me, the greatest difficulty sometimes, in some ways, that which I find most compelling also gives me the hardest time. What I find most compelling in some ways is human beings. When I look at another human being, I don't believe that they're accidents of ancient chemicals. I don't believe they're just sophisticated animals. I believe that I see before me a spirit, an embodied spirit, but a spirit nonetheless, and I feel sometimes what the Protestant theologian T.R. Deschardin said, which is that we are not material beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a physical experience. That's the good side. The hard part for me came, and I remember when I first realized it, was when my mother had an aneurysm. And because she had an aneurysm and her brain was flooded with blood when she was 52 years old, she became aphasic. That is, she can't speak. She has difficulty reading. Her thoughts often get confused. And I thought, if in fact we are spirit, then how can it be that a change to our physiology changes our personality so powerfully and so dramatically? And I have answers that sometimes satisfy me, but for me, that is the most difficult challenge personally to religion. And the only thing that I will end with is to say that for me, challenges and questions are not necessarily antagonistic to a religious spirit. That it seems to me that challenges and questions can bring you deeper into faith, and that I'm comfortable being what Rabbi Nachman of Breslov said about himself. He said, "I am a moon man. My faith waxes and wanes."
So I pose the same question to you, Christopher, right?
Yes, and just for a second to comment on what you said, if I have great difficulty with most people I meet believing that they're even intelligent primates.
And
if you think that if you make the assumption, which I do, not that we have bodies, but that we are bodies, then there isn't any mystery that remains to be explained about why a bleed in your brain will make you behave as if you weren't human anymore and can't speak or can't think. The explanation is quite ready to hand. And if you presume that we are here not because of a divine design, nor are we here under a divine supervision, but we are here because of the combination of random mutation and natural selection and evolution, again, there's no mystery. There's nothing ridiculous that you have to impose on yourself. There's no violation of Occam's rule of don't introduce absurd assumptions that's required. On the other hand, if you think, how long do you think we've been on the Earth as a species? Francis Collins of the Human Genome Project says 100,000 years. Richard Dawkins thinks it could be as long as 250,000. I'll take 100,000. For those years, 100,000, just call 100,000 years. Those years, the human species is born. Most of its children die in the process of being born. Life expectancy is perhaps 25 and pretty miserable. You'll die mainly of your teeth and very unpleasantly. There'll be turf wars over women, animals, land, panic. When the sky darkens for an eclipse, there'll be madness and rage and fear. When there's a tsunami, no one will know. There's no germ theory of disease. Unbelievable horror. But it goes on, and millimetrically things improve. And for the first 96,000 years of this, the heavens watch indifferently. And then about the largest monotheistic claim is 6,000 to 4,000 years ago, they say, actually it's time to intervene. Maybe in some really illiterate part of the Middle East. If you can believe that, you can believe absolutely anything. But you would have then to believe that this supervising deity was either very cruel and very capricious, and or, because it's not exclusive, very incompetent.
And this to you is the best argument for faith?
Yes. So, now, as to why I've ever questioned my own atheism, all of my colleagues agree, we've all discussed this a lot of times, The most intriguing argument against our position is what's called the fine-tuning argument. That if a few details of science and physics and biology and chemistry were a little different, only fractionally different, there would be nothing instead of something. It's true. I mean, it's a very intriguing thought. The fact that there is nothing, that there's something, not nothing, doesn't prove a designer, certainly doesn't prove a deity. It certainly doesn't prove a deity who cares about you or intervenes in your life or who supervises you waking and sleeping. But nonetheless, it's a thought that has to be confronted. I'll just close by saying what I've contributed, I think myself, to this argument, which is the following. As we now know, because of Edwin Hubble and many others, the universe is expanding very, very fast, has been ever since the original Big Bang, and the rate of expansion, which not even Hubble quite predicted, Lawrence Krauss worked this out a few years ago, is not slowing down, as Newtonians might have thought, it's increasing. The rate of the expansion is increasing, the redshift light. So very, very soon there won't even be any evidence in the cosmos that there ever was a Big Bang. Things will be flown so far apart. And in the meantime, and you can see it in the night sky, the Andromeda galaxy is headed directly towards ours, as it has been doing since long before we could think about such things. So very soon, what something we have will be replaced by a whole lot of nothing. So who designed that? What divine father arranged that for us? What caring person who watches over bedsides and gives people hope designed things that way? I ask you, there's only one way to grow up, and it is to stop believing that there is either a tyrannical or a benign parent who's looking out for you. In my opinion, that tyranny would be much worse if it was benign, but you have your choice. No, thank you for asking. I know I have a tendency to talk too much, don't I? Do you wish I'd talk less? Never mind. No, never mind. Look, I think it's very important to distinguish the numinous from the supernatural or the superstitious. The numinous, or you might want to say the transcendent. For example, I'll make it quick. I wrote a book about the Parthenon, a building I can't tire of. There are so many ways of looking at it from the outside, from the inside, its measurements, its symmetries, the stories told by its mutilated sculpture, the interiority and the exteriority of it, its positioning in the ancient world. Really, a good person interested in aesthetics could give a life to the study of the thing. But I have no conviction at all about the cult of Pallas Athena, which inspired its being built. I don't think the cult of Pallas Athena was a valid religion. I don't think it. I think it was a man-made cult. I have no belief that the Eleusinian mysteries held any real mystery. I think it was a piece of priestcraft. I'm sorry to say that it looks very likely as if two of the stories on the frieze actually are about a human sacrifice to propitiate a bad god. And I think Athenian imperialism in respect of not just Sparta, but the Delian and Melian islands was a terrible tyranny. Nonetheless, I could not be without that temple. So one of the great cultural and aesthetic tasks, I think, is separating the numinous, the transcendent, the beautiful, and the aesthetic from the superstitious and from the supernatural, which is a dimension that doesn't exist and that we don't need and that can't help us.
May I?
Do you want to jump in?
Sure, I'd love to. First of all, I think that here is really an area where we agree. I also don't hold with the cult of Pallas Athena. And I think that for us to find these commonalities is important. But, and by the way, I really am honestly intrigued by the peremptory statement that there is no supernatural. Because if we're talking about intellectual arrogance on the part of the believer, how can one say that as opposed to, it seems to me there's not a persuasive case for the supernatural, to say that there is no realm of the supernatural is taking an awful lot on oneself, I think. But that wasn't actually the point
nothing
I wanted to
like
make.
Nothing like the other way around.
Right, well, it was this. I believe that the reason you have a place like Pallas Athena is because human beings actually grope towards something real, though it finds many different kinds of expressions. And the reason that that's so, in part, is because we know that we live in a world in which the intangible matters. Not just intangible as we're experiencing right now, right? I'm saying words to you which are essentially intangible. You're hearing them. They're changing something about you. The physical world is changing because of the intangibility of thoughts, ideas, words, all of that. And so we have an intuition that, as Emerson said, the unseen things are eternal and the things that we see are temporal. That is, that they don't last forever, but the intangible does. But the second part of this is that the reason that consciousness seems to me so important is that we dwell in this world that we actually can't explain physiologically. And we do have intuitions that aren't a function purely of firing synapses. And not everything can be explained by neurons. And the world is a remarkably fine-tuned, if you're interested, I have a little section on that that gives you some of the statistics in the book that Mr. Hitchens has by him called Why Faith Matters. And those things, that is the idea that there are things that we cannot prove, that we cannot see, that are what we call euphemistically intuition, those things were real to ancient Greeks as they are real to us. And even though their expression finds different cultural forms, to assume that they are not real is to flatten out the world in a way, I think, that is not true to any of our experience. And you have to do violence to human experience to assume there is not an intangible realm as opposed to honoring it.
Just a note to the audience that if you have questions that you want to have submitted up here, now is a good time to write them down, and you'll find people who will collect them, because we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes. I wanted to ask you both, in reading your works and reading about you, you've both made major changes in your thinking and your outlook as adults. David, in your book, you talk about as the son of a rabbi at a tender age, 11 or 12, after seeing a very gory Holocaust film, that you became an atheist. You figured, how could there be a God? Mm-hmm. And that lasted for a number of years till you were a young adult and eventually became a rabbi. But we'll have to read the whole book to find out how that happened. Christopher, from the opening pages of your book, you talk about when you're 9 years old, you sort of saw through the God that your teacher was talking about. But I guess certainly politically, you have changed from someone from the left to perhaps it was after 9/11, but became a supporter of the Bush administration's carrying out the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Went from writing from magazines on the left to those on the right. I wondered if you could both talk just a little bit about change, which is a very popular word these days, and how you came to question your long-held beliefs and what you learned from that.
Robert, go first.
Okay. I think that for me, at least, it was a function of learning to distrust my certainty. When I was 17, I knew everything. And the older I got, the more I realized that that was a defensive illusion as opposed to a reality. And as I came to know, I mean, this is part of the problem, and I talk about this in the book, and I must say Mr. Hitchens is only glancingly guilty of this tonight, but I think that it's a common rhetorical strategy of people who argue the atheist case. They'll refer their own beliefs to reason and yours to psychology, right? In other words, I believe what I do because it makes sense. You believe what you do because you're childish, or because you had a bad mother, or because you had a bad father, or because you need a crutch. But my beliefs are beliefs of reason. And I very much thought that. I thought religious people were weak, and they were credulous, and they were uninformed, and I wasn't. But as I got older, and I learned about the lives of people whom I admired, and started to admire other people and their lives and realize that the strongest among us are sometimes weak and the smartest are sometimes foolish. It allowed me the opportunity to re-explore what I had abandoned on the basis, in part, of a shock to the system when seeing that movie, and in part on the basis of an expectation that reason was a sufficient tool to lead and live a human life. And in fact, that all the kindred things that I believe religion supports at its best, of compassion and decency and goodness and so on, they could all be subordinated if we would just be reasonable with one another. This is an illusion that I think is probably fairly common to 17-year-olds, but no grown-up should believe it. And I suppose what I'm saying is I grew up.
My own early atheism was not the same as the rabbis in that it would never occur to me if I did believe in God, that or in a supervising and creating deity, that I could possibly ask him for an explanation. I mean, you either believe that there's someone who's ineffable, unknowable, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, or you don't. You don't say, there's a God and I may as well complain to him. Why does he allow suffering? What a question. How would you know? You don't even know enough to ask the question. Otherwise, God is just a dialogue partner, man-made, as I would suggest, as I believe all gods to be. And I think your question gives away the fact that that is, in fact, the case. But the God who we're really supposed to think about doesn't owe us an explanation. It can't be asked for one. Why do bad things happen to good people? Huh. Why do good things happen to bad people? That's what worries me much more. And I see a great deal more of. So I just saw through the stupid claim that the apparent order and beauty of the universe, as my biology and scripture teacher tried to tell me, testified to an argument from design. I could see through that when I was 11, and I don't think anyone couldn't see through it by the time they were about 8. It's an argument not worth having. It's been so conclusively discredited by now that I can't believe I had it even at that age. As to the question. And by the way, I don't think any religion isn't ultimately based on an argument from design, on the idea that because there is some kind of order in the universe, someone must be ordering it. And I think the obvious fallacy of that is the beginning of one's critique. As to why I support the liberation of Iraq, support it, still do support it, nothing could be simpler. All my Iraqi, Arab, and Kurdish friends, almost all of them, Marxists of one kind or another, had for a long time been hoping that the United States policy would change from one that supported Saddam Hussein to one that asked for his overthrow. And I thought that was a reasonable request. I joined a committee that urged for it. The president of Iraq is now a democratic socialist elected a Kurd whose countrymen were being killed by poison gas en masse a few years ago, instead of a hysterical Jew-baiting, terrorist-supporting, weapons of mass destruction using Nazi. Everyone else I know thinks Iraq would have been much better off if it had been left the way it was. Fine. I don't mind being in a minority on that. I'm as proud as I could be that those Iraqis who outlived Saddam Hussein saw the destruction of his regime and his party, and the emancipation of their country and their people can count on me as a friend. It's not me who owes the explanation. The people who owe the explanation are those who thought Iraq was fine when it was the private property of a psychopathic fascist crime family that had a windpipe hold on a major jugular point of the world economy and thought that that would work out all right because he was in a sanctions box that was in the meantime killing the Iraqi people and their civil society. No. History will be very firm on this. And if it doesn't vindicate me, I don't care about that, it'll certainly vindicate the liberation of Iraq.
I'm addressing this to the congregation because we didn't say anything about asking each other questions, so I'm going to pretend that this is to you, but in fact this is a question for Mr. Hitchens. You heard him say that the one thing that gives him pause is the fine-tuning of the universe. The remarkable fine-tuning of the universe, that somehow this world exists even though the odds are astronomically small that such a world would exist. And then he said, an 8-year-old can see through the argument for design. The argument for design is that this world is in fact designed so that it exists, even though it seems very improbable that you should get such a beautiful and wonderful world. So I wonder, out into the world, how one would reconcile such a contradiction.
Well, the answer is actually partly supplied in your own book, sir, where you describe, you use the phrase very suggestively, more than once, of our creation, our little blue globe, alone as it is in the cosmos, as far as we know, being on a knife edge. Mm-hmm. This being a knife edge difference.
Yes.
That's exactly, by an odd coincidence, the expression I employ in my own book. Why do I do so? I can't say why you do, but I'll say why I do. Hugh Montefiore, Jewish convert to Christianity, later Bishop of Southwark and later Bishop of Birmingham, in his book Credible Christianity says, the conditions for life on our planet, you know, are so knife edge and so finely tuned that you can hardly believe that. Okay, yes, look how knife edged they are. Just look at our own tiny little suburb of the cosmos, just our solar system. The other planets are all either too hot or too cold to even make it thinkable that they could support life. And very large parts of our own planet are much too hot or too cold to support any life. And we well know, we have good reason to know more lately, that that knife edge of climatic crisis could tip either way very easily. So just out of one solar system, there's only one planet that isn't a complete screw-up, and it's on a knife edge. Some design. I repeat, this designer is either cruel and capricious or incompetent and bungling or both, because the two things are not exclusive. And in the meantime, the heat death and meltdown of the sun that will cause our oceans to boil before the planet turns into a crisp is already inscribed in all the laws of physics that we know, and the Andromeda Galaxy is coming our way, as I told you, and the Hubble red light shift means that there will be so much nothingness that there'll be no way of remembering there was ever somethingness. What design is this? Yes, knife edge is the right word. And that's your deity. That's your omnipotent. That's your omniscient. That's your loving. That's your caring. That's your efficient. That's your designing authority. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, I really do ask you, are you going to repose your faith in something as crackpot as that?
Well, this is a good moment to find out what the audience is asking. Thank you.
By design.
Okay. Thanks.
Durkheim. I forgot to do Durkheim.
Thank you.
We'll come back to it.
Whoa.
Want me to riff for a minute while we...
Durkheim, I was going to say,
yes.
Durkheim really does show, surely, in his yes. elementary forms of religious life, that you ask someone, why are you a Catholic? He'll say, because my parents were from Poland. Right? You're completely right in saying, yes, that these are communal, that they're designed for civic and social solidarity.
Absolutely.
That's exactly right. Why was I baptized in the Church of England?
Call something communal does not suggest that communal is all it is, which seems to me to be a trope that I hear often. You define something in terms of its physical manifestation or its communal manifestation as though that invalidates the possibility that there is anything greater that also impinges on it, but I think that there's...
To say that religion and all churches are and religions are man-made isn't to criminalize them or make them contemptible. It's simply to say that they are not divine institutions. The Pope may claim to hold the keys of Peter and be the vicar of Christ on earth, but he's a bloody fool for believing that. And an arrogant one, too. And those who do believe in it are credulous and easily led. That's why they're called sheep. That's why they call themselves sheep. By the way, Bishop of New Guinea had a debate with him on the BBC the other day, trying to spread Christianity to Borneo, and I said, we can't do sheep there. They've never seen a sheep. Large parts of the world aren't sheep-oriented or even goat-oriented. What does the Bishop of Borneo now say on Easter for the Church of England as he rises in his pulpit and addresses the congregation? O Lord, behold these thy swine.
Yeah.
Because that's the valuable animal in those latitudes. Religion is man-made, excuse me, and it shows.
One second, I can't let that go, not because you mentioned swine, but... but because religion operates by metaphor. It does. And the reason it operates by metaphor is exactly what you said earlier.
Because it's
which
man-made.
Which is, you know what, you're not actually allowed to insert my answers into my own sentences. I mean, you can, but the reason that it operates by metaphor is precisely what you said before, which is you knew early on that if there was a God, that God was ineffable, that God was not to be understood by human beings, and therefore, if you were going to talk about that God, you had to speak about that God metaphorically, not literally. And so when you say sheep and then you make the metaphor literal, of course it sounds silly, as many metaphors do, but if you think of sheep as representing those who willingly follow the shepherd because the shepherd is going to protect them and make sure that they're all right and fend off those things about them that are dangerous and teach them how to stay together as a flock.
You think that's why shepherds look after sheep?
Then the point, again, you're literalizing the metaphor. The idea of the metaphor is to tell people that which the religion teaches as a value. It's not in order, it's not a literature class. It's not so that you can dissect it and understand what sheep really do and why, you know, why sheep is an inadequate idea for a human being to act. That, and I just want to put a last spin on this. A good theologian of any monotheistic tradition will say that the difference between God and a human being is infinitely greater than between a human being and, say, a one-year-old. No one-year-old could possibly understand Christopher Hitchens, right? You said that you have trouble even thinking of adults as intelligent primates. So certainly no one-year-old could. If that's the case, then I have to take your assumptions about God's incompetence with just a grain of salt, because as someone who believes in God, I think God may know better.
Your claim to know the mind of God is, of course, a claim where I can't follow you.
I didn't say that.
I don't know where
you... When did I claim... Hold on, you just attributed it to me. When did I claim to know the mind?
God would prefer bed three to bed one. I don't know how you know this. I have no idea. I can't make this claim.
I said the exact opposite. You must have misunderstood.
Or might prefer bed one to bed three. You had an idea of what God might want.
No, I said that I did not
Either way, you had an idea of what God might want. Your book mentions it all the time. You seem to have a knowledge... It's denied to me, completely denied to me, and everyone else I know, of what the divine and ineffable might expect or want from us. But on there I can't follow you, there you can play a card that I cannot.
But you do.
You trump me.
You play it over and over again.
You have a knowledge of the mind of God, and I don't.
On shepherds,
I can be clearer.
Yes.
Shepherds don't look after sheep because they love them, though I think some shepherds actually do love their sheep too much. Shepherds look after their sheep.
By the way, God doesn't like that.
They look after the sheep so that they can first fleece them, and second, turn them into meat.
Now,
that's much more like the priesthood as I know it.
Since I appeal to those who have heard you say again and again, if there is a God...
The sexual element isn't absent from that either, actually.
That's okay.
Since we are flocking around here.
Look, toleration is a religious
virtue.
Maybe
someone should ask a question from
the... Wait. No. That's not fair. You can't get away by saying you don't presume to know... You don't presume to know the mind of God when you say again and again, if there is a God and he wants this... I don't like it. If there is a God and he wants that, that's not a God I would believe in. That kind of God doesn't make sense. That God would say, that, I mean, you use the same trope, the same idea, but from the other side.
Not at all. Mine is conditional. Mine is an if. If you say this is designed, some designer. Mm-hmm. If you say it's compassionately designed, some compassion. It's always if. It's conditional. I don't concede there's any such thing. Okay. You say God would like this of us. We would hope this of him. Where you're getting it from? I don't know, but it's a claim where I cannot follow you. And I would like to ask you how it is that you do have an insight into what God wants.
Well, I think we
That's
ought
to denied give, to me.
I think we ought to give the audience a chance. They've been very patient listening. They have some fascinating questions, the ones I can read. The first one I came to, but we're going to gloss over, says, is for you. It says, why are you such a contrarian? But we'll come back to that one later. This
I have no idea.
This one is for both of you. It says, scientific research has shown that there may be a, quote, religious gene, that religion is hardwired into our genes. If so, what does that say for free will? Maybe we don't choose to have faith. Maybe it's just genetic.
I'd like to expand that. Do you believe in free will?
I think we have no choice. But I'll tell you, something I'm sure of. You cannot be given free will. It is often said that God gives us free will. If it's given to you, it's not free will by definition.
Where does it come from?
Well, I believe that it involves the risk of saying that your own responsibility is what you face the cosmos.
No, what I'm asking is, if you're...
There is no invisible means of support.
What I'm asking is, if you're born and you don't choose your genetics, and you're born into an environment that you do not choose...
Yes.
Where does your free will come from if it doesn't come from something
in
beyond
yourself? In a sense, ex hypothesi, in a sense, out of that very suggestion. If you say, here it is, I was born into a world I didn't make, I've got to make the best of it I can, there is no supernatural dimension, there's no invisible means of support on which I can call, I'm alone with the cosmos and with my fellow creatures, that's free will.
No,
that's why,
will is actually the ability
religion
to choose.
Religion is a flight from that.
No, wait. Free will is the ability to choose, and what I'm asking is scientifically,
no, it isn't the reason,
not philosophically, how do you have the ability to choose if you're a collection of genetics and environment, neither of which you chose, which determine your behavior?
Okay, there's a word that hasn't come up yet this evening, but I think has a place even in the house of worship. Perhaps especially a Jewish one. It begins with E. It's called evidence. It's amazing the word hasn't been used yet. It's my fault, too. What if it turns out to be the case, right, that evolution by natural selection and random mutation is a sufficient explanation for our presence here? What if that's true? All the evidence is that it is true. The evidence against it is nil, nothing. There isn't any evidence against it. It's all been discredited. Say, well, isn't that rather a bleak feeling? Doesn't that just make us another primate mammalian species who may even, when we feel love, be undergoing a chemical reaction? We know all these reductionists. Well, maybe. But first, is it true or not? Now, what you say is, I don't like the idea of it, so why don't I say that God's given me the choice to not believe it? Well, come on. I mean, give us a break. Do us
well,
a
actually,
favor.
Actually,
it's either true or it isn't.
Let me clarify my question, because I actually didn't say whether I liked it or not. I asked you, where do you get your free will, and what you gave us a lovely
from
peroration on evolution.
From the acceptance of my solitude
but
and sole responsibility. I can't refer my problems upward
but you're not
to a dictator. I can't.
Question. You're not answering the question.
You want
genetic-
me to give my free will away and to give it away in prayer and to ask for a divine supervision replace my responsibility.
I want
that
to answer step one before we get to step two. Forget whether God exists or not or gives you free will or not. Let's say there is no God. Do you have free will? And if so, if it doesn't come from your genes and you don't choose your environment, then where do you get it from? You can't say you get it from your acceptance because your acceptance is also predetermined by your genes and your environment. So what I want to know is, do you say we don't have free will? Or do you have some scientific hypothesis about the origin of free will that I'm unfamiliar with?
The reason why I said we have no choice but to believe in it is that, try the thought experiment for yourself. We have no choice but to assume we have free will. The choice is forced upon us. Free will is compulsory because of the situation in which we find ourselves. Try the thought experiment the other way around. Suppose you can believe with Calvin, for example, mm-hmm. Or actually with Laplace, who was a great physicist,
yes.
That everything that will ever happen to you, that you'll ever think or do or say, was decided for you before you were born. It was all inscribed, it was all written. As many Islamic fatalists also say now. Suppose you actually believe that. What difference does it make to the decisions you have to make all the time? What difference does it make?
I will leave my question
You still have to act as if. You still have to act as if you must make choices, and that these choices are determined by morality and responsibility, and you'll just have to hope that what was inscribed for you astrologically before you were born favors the right choices. But it's tautology.
In the interest of time, because we promised you each 3-minute final...
Well, we could forego that, perhaps.
It's not like you haven't had a chance to go at each other, so that's fine.
I'm beginning to feel a bit tongue-tied, I've got to say.
This is for Rabbi Wolpe. You admit that religion can lead indirectly to violence and evil. What would you do to help minimize religion's contribution to violence and evil? How would you deal with extremists in your own religion?
I think one area where we agree is extremism in religion is very resistant to moderation, and that troubles me. I think that's true of extremism in general. True believers, as Eric Hoffer taught us a long time ago, whether they are believers in communism or in religions that are believers such that they feel as though anything outside of themselves is illegitimate and ought to be destroyed, pose the great risk to the future of the human species. The only thing that I can say is that it seems to me religion provides the only principle on which all human beings can in theory, agree on the universality of goodness. That is, by that I mean, if in fact there is a God who superintends the entire world and believes all human beings are valuable, as the Jewish tradition, for example, teaches when it says that the righteous of all nations have a share in the world to come, then that's a principle that could be inculcated and perhaps could prevail. What I don't know, and what I would be interested in hearing Mr. Hitchens address, is if there is in fact nothing other than our accidental appearance here, and it favors my group that your group be destroyed, what possible countervailing principle would persuade me otherwise? I think religiously we have a principle we can deploy. It doesn't always work, but we can deploy. I'm not sure without it what principle we would use.
I don't think that the distinction between the moderate and the fundamentalist is as facile as that or as easy to evade. What's the principal question here? Are these books holy and divinely inspired and containing a mandate of obedience or not? Or are they man-made books, a simple accumulations of fragments and myths and different accretions? I'm absolutely certain that there's nothing to decide in that question. They're obviously the second. But if you think they are divine, how are you going to escape their injunctions? What if it happens to say that in the Old Testament that thou shalt not suffer a witch to live? What are you to do? You can't say there are no witches.
Is this
rhetorical? Otherwise they wouldn't be saying that you have to kill them. There must be some. They may not be evident. You have to go find them. Then you have to burn them. It's a mandate. Now, to me, this is utterly nonsensical. It's white noise. I don't understand how anyone can fall for it ever. There is no divine inspiration in these books. There is no such thing as divine inspiration. The books are man-made, and it shows, just as it shows that we are only half a chromosome different from chimpanzees. Who can't tell that when they look at their fellow creature?
Should I hold on?
Let's move on. I want you to know I have a really good answer,
If this is the word of God, you can't take it a la carte. If this is the word of God, you can't select from the menu
that's,
in the cafeteria.
I'm sorry, but that's not true, and no religion works that way. In fact, I'll give you a perfect example. It says explicitly in the Bible that a rebellious son should be stoned. The rabbis say a rebellious son never was and never will be. In fact, religions do precisely what you say religions can't do. That is, they interpret, understand, grow morally, get to know God better. They explore the Bible by the principles of the Bible.
How convenient.
And that's, it's not convenient. It's actually called the progressive knowledge of what we understand to be the will of God.
What about the mandate for genital mutilation?
Are you talking about circumcision that the World Health Organization recommends?
No.
Oh, because that's
what they
do. I'm
talking about genital mutilation.
Oh, well then, fortunately, the stripping,
you know very well what I'm talking about. Don't pretend you don't. Not making, right. Not loosening the foreskin or slightly excising it. No.
Right.
The full periamacetes of the stripping.
Yes.
The attempt to dull the penis. The attempt to cripple the male organ of generation in the name of God. What about that?
Is that a covenant
or is it not? I'd like to know. Because you're the one who has the relationship with God.
From my point of view, yes, it is a covenant, and it's not detrimental, and that's why I appeal to the World Health Organization.
Why were you reluctant to say that?
I'm not reluctant to say that.
You were palpably reluctant to say that.
I just said it.
All right,
no. I'm palpably reluctant.
You had to be prodded three times before you agreed to the question.
We're going to move on now.
I know why you're reluctant.
Wait, let's...
Okay.
Thanks. Your title, this question says, your title says, God is not great, but then the subtitle says, why religion poisons everything. What do you make of religion and religious expression that is centered around the community? Is there value to religious community irrespective of God?
Well, that's probably that was written before we had our brief exchange on Emil Durkheim and on the idea that religion is communal, something we do have between us as a consensus. The Greeks, I know, why do they go to the Greek Orthodox Church? Because they're Greek. Same for the Russians, same for the Serbs. Same for most Polish and Irish people. It's the reason why Tocqueville is right about American civil society. Religion is the great voluntary effort that people make, and it's the only country in the world where the state is forbidden to encourage a religion or help pay for a church. So it's the great thing a community can do to prove it exists, is to build and keep going a house of worship. Makes it entirely different. But it, excuse me, materializes my point that it is a man-made phenomenon, that none of these churches are built because God wants them to be built. Now, do I have to... please don't make me say any of that again. Please, anyone who has that question, please don't make me say it again, because it'll make me sound boring. Religion is man-made, and it shows, okay? Even this beautiful place testifies to that.
Okay, what we're going to do now, I'm going to ask you each, we don't have to formally go to the lectern, but if you can sum up in 3 minutes.
Would you accept my proposal that we have, because we have
sure.
both rather babbled.
Absolutely.
That we rather have some more questions?
Oh, okay.
Would that be fair?
That's fine.
Okay,
sure.
Okay. This one is a first for you.
Oh, good.
With what beliefs would you raise children? What would you say to a four-year-old who asked you about God?
Well, my daughter has to sit through a little Passover ceremony every year, whether she wants to or not, with a little Seder. Doesn't go on for very long, but I make her answer some questions. I show her I explain to her how it's also related to the, how it's related to the Greek symposium, how it's a Platonic idea. People lie around. It's supposed to be recumbent, drinking wine, asking questions, and bringing in the young. And the connection between Athens and Jerusalem is very important to me, as is the distinction between them that everyone's always noticed from Matthew Arnold to Leo Strauss. Everything is as between Athens and Jerusalem. I'm for Athens myself, but she has to know that there's a tradition that she and I and her mother come from. And I wouldn't have her not know that. But it would never occur to me to say that she had to attend a place of worship or had to believe that she was created or supervised, but I'll allow her to find all that out for herself. But there are bits of it that I think are a responsibility. In the meantime, she goes to a Quaker school and campaigns for Barack Obama.
And all I
nothing
can say,
I can do about that either.
And all I can say is, in my catalog of unrealized wishes for my life, I'd like to be able to say, oh, I'm having the Hitchens over for Passover.
Mm-hmm. It's not hard to do.
Do you want to address that as well in talking about...
I think that would be...
Okay.
Do you know? I should say my other children are Greek, so it doesn't apply to them. Their mother is Greek, but in case you wondered.
For you, Rabbi, Europe is far more secular than the U.S., but its crime rate is significantly lower than our own. How would you account for that?
I think that it's interesting what has happened to Europe, and it will be interesting to watch the experiment in the coming years. I would say there are two factors in Europe that we'll see how they play out. One is, of course, that Europe has undergone a series of traumas that the United States knows nothing of. And the degree of violence that Europeans have seen firsthand over the 20th century may have some kind of irenic, it would be nice to think, effect on Europe. And the other is that European nations tend to be homogeneous, and America is very heterogeneous, which means we have lots of different groups together in the same place. Now that there is much more mobility around Europe, we'll see if that holds. I hope that it will. And the last point I would make is you get a surprisingly high number of Europeans who say they are religious, over 60-65%, even though they don't attend a church, they don't attend a synagogue. So it seems to me this is the beginning of a social experiment, and it will be worth watching to see what happens.
I don't think the assumption that Europe is more secular is necessarily correct. or that Americans are more religious. I find that many Americans, even those who identify with churches and synagogues and mosques, are much more riddled with doubt than they will admit. Whereas in Europe, say in my country of birth, people are forced to pay taxes to sustain a church where the queen is the head of the church as well as the head of the state and the armed forces. And the moment she dies, her bat-eared, slobbering, chinless son, who is a fan of Islam and has no taste in women, will become at that moment the head of the Church of England. And I'll have to pay for it, or I would if I lived in England. That's what you get if you found a church on the family values of Henry VIII. This is not secularism. And the point that I make about Islam is not frivolous either. The Europeans have decided to import into the center of their society the same crisis that obtains in the ghetto areas, in the most remote and backward areas of the Muslim world, because that's where their immigrants have come from. And they've imported into the middle of their society the resources and the population of a future a jihad, something that wants to take away everything they've got and change all their laws and alter all their customs. And it's on the future of that struggle that everything will depend.
And I think that it's important, and I'm sure, I think virtually everybody here will agree that the only helpful formula in our time for religion, which is helpful both for religion and for the state, is for them to be separate. And to the extent that they become too mixed, is a danger for both, not only for the state, but also for religion.
I asked a Christian pastor earlier today this question, and I just, if I may, out of curiosity, I'd like to ask you, if you could picture someone being born in Saudi Arabia now, today, this evening, tomorrow, would you rather that person was an atheist or a Muslim?
It would depend, really, what I would prefer is I would prefer they would be an enlightened Muslim, because then they might have an opportunity of influencing the people around them, whereas if they were an atheist, they wouldn't.
All right. It's a brave answer. Suicidal, but brave.
All right, we have time for one more question, and I'll ask you both to respond. It's initially for you. It says, you've asked for a single historical example of a religious person who was engaged in an act of great moral goodness or valor that could not have been performed by a non-religious person. And cites the example of Roy Klein, a soldier in the Israeli army during the recent war in Lebanon, who in a split-second decision and with a shout of Shema Yisrael, gave his life by deliberately jumping on a grenade to save the lives of his comrades. While non-religious people have in many cases given their lives for a moral cause, how many of them were able to make that choice in a matter of seconds?
Okay, no, it's a good try, but it's, as you can see, hopeless. What if he'd shouted Allahu Akbar when he was doing that? Would it mean the same to you?
Well, this is to save
Well, no,
people,
I'm saying, well, first, second, how can you tell that a non-believer wouldn't risk or give their own life to save their comrades? It's an insult to non-believers to say that we couldn't do that without divine permission. I don't say I would do it, but I don't say that anyone who could say Allahu Akbar would be more likely to do it either. And furthermore, I would very strongly distrust the motive, which I think would taint the fineness of the action. So my challenge still stands, in case people haven't heard it before. You have to name a moral action performed or a moral statement made by a believer that could not, I repeat, could not be performed by a non-believer. No one. I've tried it with the Archbishop of Canterbury. I've tried it with the Pope's confessor. I've tried it in print, on television or radio, hundreds of times in many audiences. There is no answer to it.
Sure there is.
And that wasn't one.
I don't know what
he was doing in Lebanon in the first place.
What's
he doing in Lebanon? He's an Israeli.
The answer to the question is, when you say could not, I mean, it's true that religious people don't sprout wings and they can't do things that non-religious people can't do physiologically, but anything from Handel's Messiah to Donne sonnets to Hopkins poetry to blessing your daughter on a Friday night, which I do, to praying together at the bed of someone who's sick, to creating a Shiva minyan for people who are ill, to having, by the way, a religious experience. All those are things that non-religious people can't do that religious people can do. And
the latter is true.
And if the latter is true, then I've answered the question, and I'm happy to finish it with a flourish. I will quote, no, 1 second, here, hold it, the flourish is to come. I will end it by quoting an Islamic thinker, and it seems to me an appropriate comment to make to somebody who wrote the preface to Kingsley Amis's sprightly book on drinking. Al-Ghazali said, I can describe a religious experience to you, but describing a religious experience is to having one, as reading about alcohol is to getting drunk. So I would say that you can have a religious experience if you're a religious person. It's powerful, it's pervasive, and if it's not too presumptuous, I hope one day you do.
Thank you. I should really leave it at that, shouldn't I? But there's something about me. A religious experience, I'm sorry, is not a moral action or a statement. It just isn't. It doesn't meet the qualification. It just doesn't. Okay. Does it? To say to have a religious experience is to perform a moral action or to utter a moral statement isn't the case. Second, you're wrong in saying that the religious people are physiologically the same. If you don't believe in miracles, I don't think you are a religious person. If you don't believe in the supernatural, I don't think you're a religious person. If you don't believe in divine intervention, you're not a religious person. Thomas Aquinas believed himself to be capable of levitating and frequently flew around the nave of Notre Dame de Paris. Mm-hmm. Well attested, it's said, by all Catholics. Yeah. It's not the case that it's just a difference of opinion. It's all the difference in the world between whether or not you believe in reason, evolution, human solidarity as the source of such morality we have, or whether you think we are supervised creatures, disposable, dispensable, part of a plan of which we have no knowledge and of which we're not considered worthy to have knowledge.
Well,
that's all the difference in the world.
That's right. Well, not surprisingly, while you've both educated us and entertained us, we haven't quite resolved the issue. I'm tempted to suggest that everybody can go downstairs for the reception and let these two gentlemen continue to fight it out and lock
until
up.
Until the last dog dies.
And lock up. But what we're going to do is that you're all invited to the reception downstairs. Both gentlemen's books are for sale, and they both have agreed to stay and sign for you. So we invite you all to continue the discussion downstairs, and I want to thank everyone.
Thanks for coming.
And particularly Rabbi Wolpe and Christopher Hitchens.
Great pleasure.
Very good.
Thank you.